From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
If you want to have a stable middle class, you'd focus on a good education, good health care, and a good job. You want our country to do well going into the next millennium, you'd focus on a good education, good health care, and a good job. You want to reduce this violence, hold people accountable when they commit brutal crimes, but understand the essential truth. We can build a million new prisons, and we'll lock them all up, and we'll never stop the cycle of violence until we invest in the health and skills and intellect and character of our children, focus on a good education, good health care, and a good job.
Minnesota Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone gets back to basics, and over 1,000 Chilean exiles march in Barcelona. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate is slated to vote today on massive $500 billion legislation to fund nearly one-third of the federal government, which the House approved yesterday. The 40-pound, 16-inch-tall bill includes dozens of high-profile spending compromises on issues such as funding the International Monetary Fund, hiring 100,000 new teachers, providing relief for farmers and ranchers, and injecting billions more into the nation's armed forces. From the sublime to the ridiculous, the crucial to the arguably inconsequential, as the Washington Post puts it, the bill's 3,825 pages included so many provisions that even members who helped draft it confessed to ignorance about exactly what was in it. The Senate was expected to vote to approve the measure this morning, joining the House in clearing the measure for President Clinton's signature and sending members home to campaign barely 2 weeks before the November 3rd elections. The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is saying that Washington's continued failure to pay its bills will threaten its vote in the General Assembly next year and will lead to a backlash against enacting U.S.-demanded reforms. The United States is expected to pay the United Nations the minimum it needs to preserve its vote in the 185-member General Assembly. But Congress failed to act on a spending bill concerning the $1.3 billion the United Nations says the United States owes in back payments. The State Department's top Africa official, Susan Rice, warned yesterday that the burgeoning list of African countries jumping into Congo's conflict risk igniting that continent's first world war. Federal prosecutors and the FBI have launched an investigation into whether six Houston police officers violated the civil rights of a man killed during a botched drug raid. The special agent in charge of the Houston FBI division said yesterday his office would look into the death of Pedro Oregon Navarro. Oregon's family, Latino activists, and politicians in the nation's fourth largest city called for a federal probe after a state grand jury on Monday declined to indict the officers on murder charges. One officer was charged with misdemeanor trespassing. Oregon was shot to death July 12th after six police officers, acting on an informant's tip, stormed his Houston apartment in search of drugs. He was shot a dozen times, including nine times in the back. California Governor Pete Wilson is being sued over a $250,000 contribution, which was transferred to a campaign aimed at passing a June ballot proposition. Tony Miller, a Democrat who ran unsuccessfully for Secretary of State and Lieutenant Governor, contends Wilson violated state election laws by failing to immediately report the contribution to the Yes on 226 campaign. Wilson-controlled Yes on 226 campaign was aimed at passing Proposition 226, which would have prohibited unions from using member dues for political activity unless union members annually authorized it in writing. It was defeated in June. Miller contends the $250,000 contribution from the California Restaurant Association and the National Restaurant Association was received by Wilson on May 10th, but not reported as a contribution to the Yes on 226 campaign until May 29th, 4 days before the June election. And this news also from California. Four members of the Environmental Greenpeace group chained themselves to cranes on a 570-foot Canadian cargo ship as it entered Long Beach near Los Angeles yesterday in a protest aimed at saving a British Columbia rainforest. That's some of the news. As Congress votes today on a final $500 billion spending package, it'll most likely be remembered as one that favored a multi-million-dollar investigation on President Clinton's sex life over the rights of ordinary Americans. In their vote for the nation's spending package, legislators approved the biggest military spending increase since the Reagan presidency, but failed to address Americans' social needs such as Social Security, health care, and education. As one of the last progressives in a conservative Congress, Senator Paul Wellstone, the Democrat of Minnesota, recently addressed those bread and butter issues at a conference entitled Back to the Basics. It was sponsored by The Nation, Mother Jones, and In These Times, and took place in Chicago.
I want to start out with one Minnesota story before this gets so serious. And it's a true story, and I think it probably has something to do with why we're here. In a way, there's a connection, Glenn, to some of what you were talking about. And of course, Jim was a great ag commissioner, and he knows all about this. In the mid-1980s, my very dear friend, probably best friend, Mike Casper, who's here tonight from Northfield, knows all about this. We were working together. A lot of farmers were being driven off their land. That's exactly what's happening right now. And part of the problem was, though there was some good organizing, and some of you probably were doing that, in many cases the farmers had no empowering explanation about why they were driven off their farms, where not only they worked but where they lived, or what they could do about it, how they could speak out and fight for themselves. And when that happens, it's fertile ground for politics of hatred to fill that vacuum. And that's what happened, and we had kind of precursors to armed militia, posse comitatus, and some other politics of hatred groups. So I've been doing a lot of organizing, traveling, speaking in different farm gatherings, and some friends got together with me, and they said, look, you know, this politics of hatred, it's racist, anti-gay lesbian, it's anti-Semitic. You ought to really stay away from some of these gatherings. Now, if you're five and a half, you don't pay any attention to that advice. And some of you know what that means. And so I went to speak to Mike and Nancy, where Joel and Patty live, to ALEC, Xandria, Minnesota, and Western Minnesota that we call ALEC. I spoke at this rally, finished up, and this big guy, a lot of guys look big to me, came up. And he said, what nationality are you? And I thought, I can't believe this. I said, American. He said, where were you born? I said, in the United States, Washington, D.C. He said, where are your parents from? I said, my father was born in the Ukraine, although he fled Russia. And my mother's family came over here from the Ukraine, although she actually was born in the Lower East Side of New York City and grew up there. He said, then you're a Jew. And now I wrestled at the University of North Carolina, and I was ready to be a little macho here for a moment. And I said, yes, that's true. And he stuck out this big hand, and he said, well, buddy, I'm a Finn, and us minorities have got to struggle together. It is one of the reasons that I love Minnesota. I suppose, you know, we don't have to agree on everything, but we have to do this together as well. One just timely remark, as we look to the future, I just would be remiss if I did not mention the next 4 weeks that are before us. I think there is an effort on the part of Gingrich et al. To sort of turn people off, and we're trying to turn people out, and I think the turnout is going to be critical in a lot of states, and in a very interesting, ironic way, the base, many of us and many of the people we organize with, are going to be really critical, and every single person that turns out is going to count really more than one. And in all due respect, I understand all of the imperfections, believe me, of the politics, including within my own party, the Democratic Party. But I'll just tell you, there was a week in June where in the House of Representatives, the Gingrich crowd, in the same week voted to give a break to people, tax break to people, I do no damage to the truth here, with estates of more than $17 million, and in the same week voted to eliminate the low-income energy assistance program and summer jobs for kids. And I have been in these conference committees where I have just seen this sort of how punitive some of these folks can be, where we wanted to have states given the opportunity to allow a welfare mother to finish 2 years of school without being driven out of school so she and her children could do better. That was eliminated, where I had an amendment passed the floor of the Senate based upon a very one of the most emotional 3 hours I've ever spent at a place called Tallulah Corrections, quote, Correction Center in Louisiana. I couldn't believe the conditions, which would provide money to states if they wanted to. You know, I'm trying to figure out what can pass to put some prison construction money instead into mental health treatment for kids, assessment, diversion, alternatives to incarceration. Looks like that's going to be eliminated. And I can go on and on. I just give these as examples that I do think that there is really something at stake. And you've got Newt Gingrich, who is Speaker of the House. You have Trent Lott, who's the Senate Majority Leader. That represents, by the way, everybody, a pretty significant transfer of power in America in the wrong direction. I'd hate to see them with even more power. And I don't know how many people are from Illinois, but if you are, just to use one example, Carol Moseley Braun is someone you need to be out there supporting. And for those of you who are from, and I'm going to be remiss, and I'm not going to take a lot of time in all races, but somebody mentioned Lane Evans. Yep. Let me just tell you, Lane Evans is a saint. Lane Evans has the most integrity of anybody you'd ever meet in politics. And I won't mention a lot of other House races, but for those of you from California, Barbara Boxer is in a tough race. And for those of you from Wisconsin, Russ Feingold is in a really tough race. And for those of you in Washington, it's Patty Murray. There are a lot of things going on, and I hope we will pay some attention over the next 4 weeks. I know you will. I just want to tell you that I do think these elections are extremely important. Let me thank you. Talk about you. I don't know everybody here, but I know some of you looking out, and you are very inspiring to me, and I'm not trying to be Mr. Politician. When I was a teacher, the best thing I ever said to students is, I will have a lot of admiration for you students if you can figure out a way of not separating the lives you live from the words you speak. And I'm not trying to get any of you to feel so self-righteous, but I do admire the fact, Jim, that there's so many people here who are so committed and who have done so much in their lives to make this a much better country. And I just want to make it crystal clear to you that your commitment and your work is very inspiring. And I honor you for all that you have done and all that you will do. I also want to thank you because many of you really have helped me, because some of you are from Minnesota. But even if you aren't literally from Minnesota, I feel like it's the same family, and it's a little bit like what Jane said. I really won't spend much time at all on our campaign in 96, except to tell you that I think it had something to do with critical ingredients that sort of apply to your work. On the one hand, nobody should believe that there isn't a place for ideas and for direction and for policy, and for words that inspire and for words that move people. That is critically important. People yearn for that. They yearn for that. And many of you work on that. And many of you are a part of that intellectual policy words as writers, as speakers, as intellectuals, as educators, as community activists. On the other hand, if you just do that, And we need to do that, because if you don't have the direction, and I think that's part of what we're talking about at this conference, then you can have a movement without a head. You need the direction. On the other hand, you can have the best ideas and write the best books and all the rest. If you don't have a constituency that can fight for it, then it's not going to happen. And interestingly enough, some of my travels suggest to me that some of the most exciting things that are happening in the country are the community organizing and some of the union organizing. There's some exciting organizing in the unions of organizing the unorganized. There's some exciting community organizing that I've seen. There have been some great victories on living wage efforts. I've had a chance to be with some of those organizers. There's some important clean money, clean election initiatives. The interesting thing is that the whole doesn't equal the sum of the parts, and I think we ought to think about ways in which that, whatever form it is, and this is sort of takes a lot of analysis, somehow has much more of a presence and has much more of a standing and how we sort of build more clout, because we need to do that. That's part of the challenge. But that's part of it. And the other part of it is, of course, the electoral politics. And electoral politics without good community organizing is all too often a politics without a base. But for those who say they want nothing to do with it, that's one of the major ways we compete for power in our country. And so I think we marginalize ourselves, and there's some very good electoral politics people here. So for all the work you do on all those fronts, I thank you. And in Minnesota, I think the one thing we did, Mike and Nancy, that maybe worked better than anything else, I could talk about a lot of things, but there were two things that might apply to the work that we're all doing. One is we did merge the community organizing and the electoral politics. So over a two-year period, we had about 850 house gatherings, and people did own the campaign, and we built a pyramid. And at the very end, when there was more and more sleaze ads on television, since I knew we could never match them TV ad for TV ad, we really had a great grassroots organization. And in the last week, without any exaggeration at all, I have too much respect for you to do that, we made 10,000 get out the vote calls every hour of the day, and we won by 9 points. And we won by 9 points. The other thing is, which I still think really applies, and it's sort of going to be the point I want to make by way of analysis. First, I'll start out with a kind of fun way, and then get more serious about it. As the attack increased, and Jim has heard me say this before, and I apologize, but always feels so good to say it, and in a way it's a good case study. As the attack increased, what I love to do, if you don't have any humor, we can't be as funny as Hightower, but if you don't have the humor, you're in big trouble. And you know, you scare people, right? You scare people, you really do. What I would do is, as all this attack was going on, I just loved to try to, you know, as we were campaigning, anytime there was a chance to look at a TV camera, I would say, you know, some of this attack is true. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies and the big oil companies and the big insurance companies and the big pharmaceutical companies, they don't like me very much as the United States Senator, but they already have great representation in Washington. It's the rest of the people that need it. I'm a senator for children and education and working families, and that's why I think we won. And I think that's an important message for all of us. I think that one of the interesting things, and maybe this is a kind of a curious, I don't know, riddle or something, Jim, that we need to solve, is that it's not like we're having a conference here and we have to get all depressed about and say to ourselves, gee, why doesn't people care about progressive politics? Why do we have such a losing politics? That's not true. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you look at all this polling data, the focus on education, living wage, jobs, and healthcare, so on and so forth, is right on the mark. As a matter of fact, everybody, and you come from these states, have you noticed? I was talking to some people from Wisconsin. Have you noticed how many of the Republicans, even when it's not true, are running ads about how they're for children and education and health care and protecting Social Security? Have you noticed that? So the point is, let's just be clear at the beginning, the progressive politics, progressive populist politics is very much a winning politics.
You're listening to Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone of Minnesota speaking just a few weeks ago at a Back to Basics conference in Chicago. We'll be back with his speech in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the speech of Minnesota Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone, speaking just about a week ago in Chicago at a conference sponsored by Mother Jones Magazine, The Nation Institute, and In These Times. Senator Paul Wellstone.
I'm not surprised in the visits that we've had to New Hampshire. It's interesting. That's education. Central issue. You know, like if it was, it's the economy, stupid, in 1992, that might, by the way, again, be very much the central issue. But right now in New Hampshire, it's sort of education, stupid. I'm not surprised, because everywhere I go, people talk about education. I went to Mississippi a year ago, summer, to Delta, Mississippi. I wanted to go there. Whole set of issues of race and gender and poverty that have just been put in parentheses. I wanted to go. I could spend hours on the visit. I won't. But there was one gathering where we had a community meeting, and a Mr. Robert Hall stood up, and he said, a teacher, and he said, you know, about 50% of the students graduate. He said, it's really hard to kind of, as a teacher, to give students hope. He said, would you come and speak at graduation next year? And I said, sure. Then I forgot I couldn't, because I'd made another commitment. Well, no one in this room would back down or back away from such a commitment. So I asked, could I come the day before? And I was picked up in Memphis the day before, now a year later, by, I think, a Mr. Erickson. And he told me that before I would speak at the high school, I would be addressing the third and fourth graders at the elementary school, a policy address to the third and fourth graders. And I said, third and fourth graders. He said, well, yes, they're waiting for you. And I said, am I correct that this is the last day of school? And he said, well, yes. And I said, well, I'm in big trouble. And so I went there, and there on the stage, high up from where the kids were sitting, third and fourth graders, I don't know, 150, was the mic, and the principal gave me a wonderful introduction where I was to give a policy address to the third and fourth graders on the last day of school. By the way, public school, all at high school, all African American, private school, all white. So I, this one little girl, she made the class for me, thank God. She saved me. Because I said, it's the last day of school. Everybody said, yeah. I said, well, what do you like about school? And she raised her hand. She said, well, if I do good in school, I can be anything I want to be. And I said, well, some of the rest of you, what do you want to be? There were 40 hands up. Everything from, you would expect, Michael Jordan, to professional wrestler, to psychiatrist, and everything else. But you know what? There was that spark. So you could take that spark of learning in any child. I know this as a teacher. And if you ignite it, you can take a child from any background to a lifetime of creativity and accomplishment. And if you pour cold water on that spark of learning, which we do to so many children in our country, we make a terrible mistake. So when I'm in cafes, learn that from a governor in Minnesota, Governor Rudy Perpich, the discussion, Jane's right, is very concrete. I don't think any of you will be offended. By the way, I'm not talking down to anybody. I'm up here, but I'm not talking down to you, not figuratively. I don't think any of you will be offended if I tell you that nobody comes up to me in the Town Talk Cafe in Wilmer, Minnesota, and says, I want to talk to you about whether you are for the tough love of a free market or an expanded welfare state. It's never happened. Nobody's ever come up to me and asked me, are you left or are you right or are you center? Nobody has ever come up to me. I'm not exaggerating. Nobody has ever come up to me and said, I'd like to talk to you about the DLC. They don't even know what it is. Versus the liberals, what's the strategy within the Democratic Party? But people are interested, so very interested, in a politics or really that speaks to the concerns and circumstances of their lives and includes them. So it's more like this, very concrete. My daughter is working, but it's $7 an hour. With no health care benefits. My daughter is 24 and no longer on our health insurance plan and a diabetic, and I know that they can't deny her coverage, but it costs her $10,000 a year and she can't afford it and no small business can afford to hire her. Or my mother or my father has Parkinson's, never made much money, wanted to put a little bit in the savings for their grandchildren, that is their dignity, and they live in fear that they will be put in a nursing home and they'll lose everything. Or I have no health insurance at all. I am a teacher, and I have 44 students in my Spanish class, and I can't do a good job as a teacher. I am a teacher. And my second graders come to school, and many of them have had no breakfast, and they are hungry. I am a parent, and there's too much violence in the schools. I just want my kids to get a good education. I am a student, and it's taking me 6 years to graduate, not four, because I work several minimum wage jobs. These, where I am, 30, and my wife is 28, and we have two children, ages 2 and 3, and our combined income is $35,000 a year, and it costs us $12,000 a year for child care, and we can't afford it. Is there not any help? People are very focused on how they can earn a decent living and how they can give their children the care they know their children need and deserve. I could give you a kind of cadence, and I'll just kind of summarize the first part of this. And I could say to you, I think it's actually fairly sophisticated, even though it's brief. You want real welfare reform, you'd focus on a good education, good health care, and a good job. You want to reduce poverty, you'd focus on a good education, good health care, and a good job. You want to have a stable middle class, you'd focus on a good education, good health care, and a good job. You want our country to do well going into the next millennium, you'd focus on a good education, good health care, and a good job. You want to reduce this violence, hold people accountable when they commit brutal crimes, but understand the essential truth. We can build 1 million new prisons, and we'll lock them all up, and we'll never stop the cycle of violence until we invest in the health and skills and intellect and character of our children, focus on a good education, good health care, and a good job. The economic issues are winning issues, and everybody pay close attention to Bill Grider's work. pay close attention to half the world being in a depression. Pay close attention to the problem of deflation and how all of this global economics could crucially affect the quality or lack of quality of lives of people in our own country. And then there's another issue. Besides the bread and butter economic issues, or what Jim would call the workaday majority issues, which are winning issues that people care about. And it's the reform issues. It is not uncommon to talk to anybody in any cafe, and we should be strong on these issues, who feel as if both parties are controlled by the same investors. That's true. People do say that. I know that. I'm a Democrat, but I hear it all the time. It's sort of the perception that if you pay, you play, and if you don't pay, you don't play. And if we don't change this current mix of money and politics, it will surely dilute and deflate the entire economic justice agenda. It's not that people don't care about these issues. People care about all these issues that affect themselves and their families deeply, desperately, but they have the view that their concerns are of little concern in the corridors of power in the nation's capital. Even the strongest flame cannot burn in a drenching downpour. So it saddens me, as long as we're talking about kind of how we work together, to see on the one hand reform people over here, and on the other hand people doing union organizing and community organizing and talking about economic justice issues or bread and butter economic issues over here, they're interrelated. Any drive for economic justice becomes diluted and diverted by this mix of money and politics. And then I keep thinking, how can it be? You know that I do no damage to the truth, and I'm not going to bore you with all the statistics, but we could go into taxes, we could go into pension, people's pension, whole issue of Social Security and attempts to privatize Social Security, living wage jobs, good education, good health care, holding these big corporations accountable, across worries about monopoly in agriculture, in telecommunications, in financial services, in health care, patient protection, and all the rest. And all of this polling data will show the vast majority of people say, yes, this is wrong, and we want this to work better for us and for our children and our families. So why doesn't it translate itself into a more winning politics for us? I think we just have to figure out better ways of tying it together, better ways of connecting to people. And can I mention just one other thing? I think that we've got to be willing to talk about values. I tell you, this is my own view, but this is an opportunity just to share ideas. Here's the conventional wisdom, I think. They have family values, and they'll be pushing that, and we'll be pushing our populist economic agenda. And the whole outcome will be determined by whether we can overwhelm their message with our message. I don't want to give an inch on family values. A living wage job is a family value. Good health care is a family value. Good education is a family value. Reducing violence is a family value. And I think that's part of what this debate is all about. This Gingrich Locke crowd, they represent a new philosophy. I call it the new isolationism. And let me tell you, one of the things that bothers me the most about our retreat on family values is that, and I think some of us are uncomfortable talking about it, but we shouldn't be, we shouldn't give a bench on it, is that you talk to most of the people in the country, you do. You do it as well as I. I'm not saying I haven't, you haven't. And people are very focused on what can you do or what can we do? What do we say to people as progressives? by way of everything we can do, private sector policy and government policy, to make sure parents or a parent can do their very best by their kids. Because people say, when we can do our best by our kids, we can do our best by our country. That's all about family values. Instead, we've got this new isolationism. Not as in foreign affairs. It's different. It is as in human affairs. This argument that when it comes to the most pressing issues that affect your lives, there's nothing the government can and should do, people don't buy it. We've won that. Feel good about that. People don't buy that. Veterans don't buy it. Parents don't buy it when they think about higher education. People don't buy it when they think about health care or public education or all the rest. This new isolationism is as in human affairs, and it says that aloneness is the virtue. That's a values debate, I think. This is what the Gingrich crowd is saying. You have Parkinson's, and you're struggling. You're all alone. You're a single parent, and you're working, and you can't afford childcare. You're all alone. You're one of 43 million people in our country without any health insurance coverage. You're on your own. That's what this philosophy is all about. And we should directly confront it. In his new book on civility, law professor Stephen Carter, I wished I'd thought of this, talks about the early days of the railroad. Let's talk values. When the railroad was new, all sorts of people crowded together in the railroad cars that they all wanted desperately to ride. And when they did this, people developed a new sense of civility, realizing that they had to cooperate and help each other just a little bit to make the journey work to get there on time. We as a people in our country need to renew that sense of a common American journey, that sense that each of us can just give a little of ourselves to help all of us to get where we want to go. As Jim Hightower says in his book, whatever happened to the sense of we all do better when we all do better? And in taking on this new isolationism, whatever happened to there but the grace of God go I? There's a lot of goodness to people in this country. Anybody in here who's bitter about people, you're in trouble. That's a scary politics. There's a lot of goodness. We call on people to be their own best selves. We got to fight for a new century of justice. We have to fight for a new century of education. We have to fight for a new century of American citizenship. We have to fight for good jobs at good wages, for good health care for every American, for equal opportunity for every child in our country. It's the right thing to do. It's what the vast majority of people believe in. It's a winning politics.
You've been listening to a speech by Democratic Senator from Minnesota, Paul Wellstone, at a conference called Back to Basics, sponsored by In These Times, The Nation magazine and Mother Jones magazine. The conference took place in Chicago. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Allá del ancho mar, donde reviene. cantan la flor con genocidio y napalm. La luna es una explosión.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Over 1,000 Chilean exiles marched yesterday in Barcelona, Spain, calling for the extradition of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Meanwhile, the general's legal troubles deepened yesterday as Chilean exile groups in London, backed by Amnesty International and other human rights groups, requested Scotland Yard to try Pinochet in British courts under a new anti-torture law, arguing that Britain has jurisdiction because among Pinochet's victims are British citizens and Chileans living in Britain. Pinochet, who was arrested on Saturday in a London hospital as he recovered from minor back surgery, faces charges in Spain for crimes of genocide, torture, and terrorism. The Chilean exile's action in London is a backup strategy in case Spain's extradition efforts fail. Meanwhile, in Chile, a student demonstration in downtown Santiago against Pinochet turned violent late yesterday as police tried to halt the march by firing water cannon and tear gas at about 1,000 students. We now turn to Madrid, to attorney Juan Garces, who is a member of the legal team representing over 4,000 of Pinochet's victims and their family members. Juan Garces, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you tell us just who these people are that you represent?
We are representing the globality of the victims that are identified in this card, being about 4,000 persons that have been abducted, tortured, and later assassinated or disappeared between 1973 and 1990 by officers under the command of General Pinochet.
And how did you come to represent them?
Because the victims have come to Madrid. Spanish Parliament granted 14 years ago jurisdiction to the National Criminal Court of Spain to prosecute international crimes, such as the case of narcotraffic, piracy, and terrorism, and genocide, even if the victims are not Spaniards, even if the crime has been committed abroad, even if the author of the crime is not a Spaniard. And then the victims, all the associations and the individuals representing the victims came to Madrid asking for justice because in their own country the courts were closed to their claims for justice. And then they trusted me as other lawyers to represent their interest in the Spanish court.
Attorney Juan Garces, what does the extradition in Britain mean if Britain were to extradite General Pinochet to Spain? What would that mean for your clients, for 4,000 people?
Well, as you know, the extradition request must be formalized in the next 2-3 weeks. And then British authorities must take a decision. Then we don't know at this moment what this decision would be. But your question is, in case that the extradition could be granted, that's your question?
Yes, although let me first ask, now that you've said, you know, the question is, will he be extradited? What are the obstacles to extradition?
In any extradition, normal extradition for criminals, the obstacles are formal obstacles or legal obstacles in a technical way. In this case, those normal obstacles, formals and legals, you must add the diplomatic and the political ones. That makes this tradition very, very complicated, very, very complex.
What about the politics of extradition and the Spanish president? Do you expect that he would call for Pinochet's extradition ultimately?
We hope that the Cold War being over, a new international political situation is born, where the passivity and even complicity that existed in Cold War toward this kind of big crimes, big criminals, we think that maybe it's also over. So what we are living now is kind of test of this analysis, and we are pleased to see how the international relations have, the international reactions to the decision taken by the Spanish judge and the British authorities are being followed in general in positive terms by public opinion and by governments in Europe and also, I think, in the United States. So maybe this is a positive test that a new sensibility is born that opens a new ways for deterring new dictatorships, new genociders in the next future in terms of preventing their impunity that was usual during the Cold War.
What can we expect to see, Attorney Juan Garces, in the next few days? What is the political and judicial process that's going to take place?
I think that the judicial proceedings will follow its normal path according to the rules of procedure in Spain and in England. There will be certainly political maneuvers and pressures that are coming from the side of the defendants. But our expectation is that normally in the period of time that according to the international treaties on extradition that are enforced in Europe, that means before the time limit of November 25th, the extradition request will arrive to London, and then it is according to the British law and in relation with the bilateral and multilateral treaties on extradition between Britain and Spain, that a decision will be taken.
What is the attitude of the Spanish public right now? Presumably that will weigh in into the president's decision. He's very conservative. He's always supported the Chilean dictatorship. What has been the response of the Spanish public to the extradition request?
The public opinion in Spain is overwhelmingly favorable and positive toward the extradition and the trial of Pinochet. That is very clear in the Spanish newspaper, in the radio and TV commentaries. And so I think that it's very popular in Spain, this process, very, very popular.
So what would happen to General Pinochet if he was extradited to Spain? What would be the process that would be followed then? He'd be brought to Spain and put in jail first?
If the extradition is granted, of course, he will be in jail, and the trial will begin. And I can assure you that the trial will be very, very fair, with all the guarantees.
How would those 4,000 people weigh in a trial of the general who is charged with the murder and torture of thousands of Chileans? How would they be represented?
The victims.
The victims.
Oh, yes, we are the lawyers for the victims. The lawyers team that is now acting in the proceedings will continue to represent the victims if one day the trial begins.
Juan Garces, could you give us some examples from these 4,000 cases that the legal team represents? Can you give us examples of the 4,000 cases that have been brought against General Pinochet?
In 1976, in Washington, D.C., Sheridan Circle, Embassy Row, there was a bombing killing a U.S. citizen. This is Ronnie Moffitt, and the former ambassador of Chile to the United States, Mr. Orlando Letelier. The investigation that were opened there, and in this moment, showed that the author of this crime, the material responsible for this crime, were people engaged by the secret services of Pinochet. And they have been charged and declared guilty in trials in the United States, Chile. But there has been always an open question, which was the responsibility of Pinochet personally in this bombing in the United States. And there are evidences, new evidences that have came alive in the last month, in parallel to this proceeding in Madrid, that show that Pinochet himself can have the last responsibility for the bombing in Washington. So this act of terrorism is also included between among the other 4,000 cases.
What has been the reaction of the people, the families of those who've been killed to this extradition, the reactions of the families that you represent?
Well, this is a change for them, a radical change. For 25 years, they have been suffering without any hope, without any audience in the courts, abductions, tortures, murder. And then impunity for 25 years. So it's the first time in 25 years that the victims' families see the possibility of opening a trial. That makes a difference.
Now, General Pinochet granted himself immunity and made himself or was appointed senator for life after he was dictator, presumably to protect him from just something like this, so that he would be a diplomat and not open to something like this. How exactly did this happen, and what does it mean when he was granted amnesty in his own country to go after him internationally?
Well, you must make a difference between local law and international law. In local law, as far as he has the real control of the countries he still has now, he has granted himself self-amnesty and has appointed himself senator to life, and he has imposed his will to the rest of the country. But in international criminal law, the kind of crimes that for which he is accused are so spectacular, terrorism and crimes against humanity, and even self-genocide against his own national group, that in the international criminal, those are international crimes. Genocide is an international crime. Terrorism is an international crime. And international crime, there is no statute of limitation. There is no possibility of amnesty at all. And then when he has claimed in arriving to Britain that he has diplomatic immunity, that is against international law. And then it's normal that the British authorities has denied this statute of immunity and have fulfilled the order of the Spanish judge to arrest him. Arrest for preparing the extradition request.
We're talking to attorney Juan Garces in Madrid, Spain. He's a member of the legal team representing roughly 4,000 plaintiffs in a criminal case against Augusto Pinochet, who has been arrested in Britain on an extradition request from Spain. But the formal request has to be made by the president of Spain, who is making a decision on this now. Now, in your case, if he does come to Spain and is tried, will you be getting information from the U.S. government, and are they cooperating? After all, they participated in the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende, Richard Nixon, the National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, the transnational corporation ITT. So where would the U.S. administration stand on this, and do you need them?
Well, the historical facts that you are reminding are true. They have been recognized by the U.S. Senate in the Church Commission inquiry in 1975-76. But as I told you, the Cold War is over. Unfortunately, one of the consequences of the end of this, this big, important international fact is that now the Clinton administration is, in fact, cooperating with the Spanish justice. The U.S. justice and the Spanish justice are cooperating in this case. The Spanish judge has requested, through the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty between Spain and the United States, to let the Spanish judge make some inquiries in the United States concerning witnesses that are living in the United States, and also to having access to some documents that would become evidence of personal responsibility in the kinds that are under investigation. And the request was accepted by the U.S. General Attorney, and even President Clinton himself has written to some member of this Congress, particularly representative of from California, Mr. Miller, George Miller, that he is personally interested in continuing to cooperate in this investigation against the terrorism and against the human rights abuses. So you see that the change in international situation seems to be big.
And has this gotten a lot of attention in the Spanish press?
Yes. If you are opening today, the last 3 days, all the newspaper front pages have this subject, but not only the front page, 1, 2, 3 pages to this case. And there is a public discussion open, there is a public debate on this matter of impunity, big crimes against humanity. And in general, there are statements by political leaders. And I can tell you that the representatives, that political parties that represent the majority of the Spanish Congress are taking public position in favor of the continuation of this proceeding.
You've been listening to Spanish attorney Juan Garces. He's on the legal team representing 4,000 cases against the former dictator of Chile, Augusto Pinochet. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Bill Clinton spent more money in 4 years